Have you ever felt really uninspired about your dinner menu? Maybe after you've been on vacation for quite a while and all those restaurant meals start to seem the same, no matter how good they are. Or maybe you live alone or have lived alone in the past and don't cook all that much. I remember having my own apartment right after high school. I didn't cook very much then, I didn't know how, and so I was limited to the same half dozen or so dishes over and over and over. So mealtime got pretty monotonous pretty fast. I jumped at the chance to eat out anytime, anywhere with anybody at all. Maybe you can identify with that. Or maybe you've moved here from somewhere else and you miss some food that for some reason you can't find in Toronto. When we were living in Saskatchewan, we couldn't get much seafood. Being from the coast, we really missed it. And one type of shellfish that was impossible to find was scallops, or as they called them, scallops. And I heard from the first service that you call them scallops here too, is that right? Yeah, okay, you're clapping back there, all right. That must be the way to say it in Toronto too. Well, whatever they're called, we couldn't get them, and we really missed them. If you can identify with any one of these situations, longing for food you're used to, or getting tired of eating the same thing day after day, or wishing you could get some food that you can't find, then you can see where the Israelites are coming from in today's story. They've been used to foods that are on the best of today's menus too. Cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. Flavorful, delicious, versatile foods that can be made into so many tasty dishes. But now they're in the desert, and all they've got is something called manna. In fact, something is about as close as our Bible storyteller gets to describing manna. The description is so vague, we can't really get a handle on it. We read that manna tastes like something made with olive oil. Or in Exodus 16:31, it tastes like wafers made with honey. Okay, well that's nice, it tells us it's pleasant, but we don't really know what the stuff is. Maybe it's a little bland with sweet and earthy overtones. But in any case, manna is different from anything anyone has seen before or since. In fact, so much different that the people can't even describe what it is. I feel kind of that way when someone asks me to tell them what a Saskatoon berry is like. Anybody ever tried Saskatoon berries? Ah, okay, so maybe you've faced that same difficulty in trying to explain it to people back here. Well, these berries are really popular on the prairies, but I'm not sure they grow anyplace else. They look like a giant blueberry, only they're purplish pink. And they aren't juicy like other berries. They have more of a gel-like consistency, so they're really good for pies. And the taste? Well, that's the most difficult of all. The best I can do is say that they're something like the combination of a cherry and a pear. And if anybody here can do better, let me know after the service, because I'd really like to know how to describe these things. Well, manna is the same way. It's really hard to describe. You simply have to try it to really understand what it is. So we have to trust the Israelites when they say that it's bland and monotonous, and they're just tired of it. So like any of us would, in the Israelite situation, after eating this manna stuff day after day, they complained and wished for more interesting food. Quail, to be exact. If you aren't so much into game, imagine turkey or lobster or donuts or whatever it is that you like to eat as a special treat. So we're with the Israelites so far. But then the story takes a really dark turn. God gives them the quail they ask for, but the people get sick and die in the middle of eating it. Is God's gift of food, then, really a mean way to hide a punishment? Did he send them tainted meat and just call it a gift because they asked out of selfishness? If so, how can we trust this God with our lives and our requests? Because we don't always ask for the noblest things either, or with the best motives. Will God just as likely give us something bad as something good? And if not, what might be another way to understand this story? I like to watch those police dramas where investigators try to find out who did the crime and how it was committed. And they often use a fairly simple process, the five W's. What are the five W's? Anybody tell me? Whoa, that was really good. All right, you could solve crimes for sure. Of course, your wife is a novelist, so you probably do help her solve crimes. So who, what, when, where, and why? And sometimes they add how as well. I think that those five W's can help us to figure out what's going on in today's story. So let's put on our Sherlock Holmes hats and see what we can find out. The first W is who. In today's story, we're told in verse 4 that the rabble with the Israelites started craving other food besides manna. That might lead us to blame this other group, whether they're a smaller group within the Israelites themselves, or maybe some of those Egyptians that we know came out of Egypt with Israel at the time. But I think that blaming this rabble, which by the way is a great word, isn't it? Rabble. I like that one. I think blaming the rabble is just passing the buck. It's kind of like blaming Eve for Adam's decision to take the forbidden fruit. Even if she gave Adam the idea, what was wrong with Adam that he couldn't say no? Good question. Well, in our story, so what if the rabble did prompt the rest of the people to crave meat? They still had a choice, and they decided to join the complainers. We read in verse 4, just after the part about the rabble, that the Israelites started wailing. That sounds like everybody, not just a small group. And if we have any doubt, check out verse 10. Moses heard the people of every family wailing at the entrance to their tents. Everybody had bought in. Complaining was the menu du jour. Even Moses himself starts complaining. And ironically, he starts complaining about the people complaining. So there's our first W, who. And it's everybody in the Israelite camp. The next W is what. We've already looked at one side of what happened. Everybody complained. But now things get interesting. God listens, all right, and nobody in the Israelite camp can say that God does not hear their prayers. Because God sends what they ask for. They get their quail. In fact, they get so much of it that it's stacked up 2 cubits high all through the camp. I looked that up, and that's about 1 meter or 3 feet high. And it said it was as far as a day's walk in any direction. So imagine all this quail stacked so high all through the camp. And everybody collected at least 10 homers of it. That's 2,000 liters. Imagine 2,000 milk cartons. That is a lot of meat to pick up. So the people start eating. But while they're still working their way through the meat, disaster strikes. A plague is sent by God and people die. Hold that thought and we'll get to that in the fifth W, why. But now for the third and fourth W's, when and where. All this complaining takes place when? After the Israelites have seen everything that God has done. All the miracles, bringing them out of slavery in Egypt, saving them from Pharaoh's army and from drowning in the Red Sea. They know what kind of God this is. They know he can be trusted. And where are they during this time? In the arid desert. Yet the miracles are continuing even there. God gives them water where there was none. And their complaints, in fact, come right in the middle of another miracle, that of manna. There's nothing to eat out there in the desert. So every day, God makes the manna appear. All they have to do is pick it up and eat it. Yet they complain. If they'd asked for quail in a nice way, maybe it would be a little different. Maybe something like this. God, thank you for this miraculous food. We're so grateful, but we're weak and we get tired easily. Can you help us out and just send us a little meat to spice up our food a little? Well, instead of that nice approach, though, the Israelites pout and they start whining. Here's what they say. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. And who knows, maybe they added a whole bunch of other foods to the list too. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. What they're saying really is this. You know, God, we had it better in Egypt than we have it here with you in the desert. We don't want your miracles anymore. And we don't want you. Somehow they conveniently forgot about one small detail of their time in Egypt, didn't they? You know that little slavery thing? They didn't really mention that in their nostalgia. In any case, they weren't just putting a return to sender sticker on God's gifts, although that's part of it. They wanted the good old days back, when they didn't know God like they did now. Apparently, everything he'd done for them didn't mean any more to them than a few vegetables. And in fact, from what they said, a few vegetables meant more than God to them. How ungrateful and how ridiculous. Before we get too disgusted with these people, though, we need to look at ourselves. How often do we look back on the good old days when things seemed better than they do now? How often do we indulge in romantic visions of a past that we see through rose-colored glasses? When we think that everything was simpler or easier or more fun. Yet we too conveniently forget about the difficulties we had back then. And we get so wrapped up in our daydreams that we don't, and in fact can't, notice the gifts that God gives us here and now. How often do we look at those gifts that God gives us in the present, things that keep us alive and well like manna, and decide that they aren't really gifts because we don't really like them that much? A few weeks ago, we looked at the Ten Commandments. One of them had a long list of things that we must not covet belonging to our neighbor. I think we can safely extend that list to include things in our own past. We must not covet who or what we used to be. We must not covet the gifts, talents, jobs, homes, relationships, or anything that used to be ours. Those things were all gifts, but they were not meant to paralyze us in the present or the future. God is always giving us new gifts. And another Old Testament author reminds us of this in Lamentations 3. You might know this from the hymn, "Great is Thy Faithfulness." The Lord's compassions or mercies never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Let's make sure we thank God for the new gifts that he brings every morning so we can receive them rather than pining after what we used to have. So now we've covered four of the five W's. First, who? The whole Israelite camp. Second, what happened? Everybody complained about the food and more deeply about God, so God sent quail and a plague. Third, when? All this happened after the Israelites had seen God's miracles and knew how committed he was to their good. Fourth, where? The people complained in the desert, in the middle of the miracle of manna. Now the fifth W, why? It's easy to see why the Israelites complained about their food. Anybody would get tired of eating the same thing day after day with absolutely no hope of eating anything else for the foreseeable future. We get that. And we can even see why God would punish the people. We might argue with the intensity of it, but we can see why he'd be angry for sure. After all he'd done for them, they not only didn't want his gift of life-giving manna, they didn't want him. They'd rather go back to slavery and Egypt's gods. We can imagine how God must have felt when they turned their backs on him. God was their broken-hearted lover, as Duke put it recently. And God was angry. So the big question that comes up with the plague is this. Did God send a bad gift? The Israelites' request for a varied menu was reasonable. But intertwined with that innocent request was their self-deception, selfishness, and rejection of God himself. Their motives were mixed. And this is where it gets scary. Because when we ask God for something, are we really much different? Don't we nearly always have mixed motives? It's so hard to untangle our selfishness and greed from what we need and want. This is what makes it important and even necessary to find out the answer to the question, does God give bad gifts? Well, on first reading, it does sound like it in our story, doesn't it? Here's verse 33. While the meat was still between their teeth and before it could be consumed, the anger of the Lord burned against the people and he struck them with a severe plague. This sounds like they'd not even swallowed the meat when they started getting sick. There had to be something wrong with the meat in that case. In other words, God sent tainted quail, a bad gift. But fortunately, there's another option here. The Hebrew word karat is translated here as be consumed. But a more common translation for the same word is to fail or be exhausted. Then our verse would read something like this. While the meat was still between their teeth, and before they could eat all of it, the plague came. This way, the quail was perfectly fine in itself, but something happened to it over time. A very believable option is that they were so busy gorging themselves on it that they didn't take care to preserve the meat properly, and they had so much of it and ate it for such a long time. The natural result of that would be food poisoning, serious illness, and even death. It's an intriguing and a fair read of the story. Whether the plague was actually caused by food poisoning or not, I personally don't buy that God sent the Israelites tainted quail. He did send a plague to punish them, but that's different than saying that God's gift had something wrong with it. Discipline is a lot different than trickery and deception. I don't think we could trust a God who would send gifts that looked good, but were just a facade for something harmful. I know I couldn't trust a God like that. Think about it in terms of a child asking you for something that might be okay in itself, but in the particular situation, you know it comes from a less than noble motive. Maybe they want a piece of cake, which is okay, but they've already had two pieces. So you know that they are being greedy. They don't need the cake. But maybe it's a special occasion and you give it to them anyway. When you give them this treat, are you going to put a bug in it or spit on it to teach them a lesson? I hardly think so. Unless you're really nasty, you're not going to do that. Anybody with common decency wouldn't do such a thing to a child, or to anyone for that matter. And I would argue that God won't do that either. If God gives a gift, it is good, period, no matter what our motives were in asking. And you know, Jesus himself backs me up on this one. Here's Luke 11, our gospel lesson from a couple of weeks ago. Jesus said, "If your little boy asks for a serving of fish, do you scare him with a live snake on his plate? If your little girl asks for an egg, do you trick her with a spider? As bad as you are, you would not think of such a thing. You're at least decent to your own children. And don't you think the Father who conceived you in love will give the Holy Spirit when you ask him?" You know, maybe we're not all that different from the Israelites. We find it hard to trust God, too. After exploring today's story, what we can say is that with God, a gift is really a gift. He's not going to send us something nasty and call it a gift, not even if our motives are bad. Bad things happen. Sometimes they're our fault, sometimes they're not. And God can discipline us. But God is always good, and so are his gifts. If we know that, we can trust God with our past, our present, and our future. We can accept his gifts now without longing to go back to another time and another place. And we can accept his gifts joyfully without frantically looking around, as some people do on a sunny day, for rain clouds all the time. But this kind of trust is hard. I think we need to ask God for help. So will you join with me in prayer? I'm using a prayer from the Book of Common Prayer. Let us pray. Almighty and everlasting God, from whom cometh every good and perfect gift, send down upon us in this congregation the healthful spirit of thy grace, and that we may truly please thee, pour upon us the continual dew of thy blessing. Grant this, O Lord, for the honor of our advocate and mediator, Jesus Christ. Amen.